till you sit down can be viewed 5 different ways. And what we don't see most of the time is that the only thing we're seeing is our view of it. We're not seeing anything objective. We are never, ever, ever seeing what's objective, because there is no objective. We each have on our contact lenses. Let's just call it contact lenses because they're that close. They're not even glasses. They're right on the eyes. The world appears as our wounds are. We see through our wounds, through a glass darkly. Take away the glass darkly and the clear glass, we see as it is without our wounds, and then it's just the way it is. Which doesn't mean that when Matt and I are walking on the beach and I see a rainbow, he sees the same rainbow. We don't see the same rainbow. I'm seeing it through my lenses. They might be clear at the moment, but they're still a particular view, a perspective. You know, the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche said, there are no facts. There are only interpretations. There are no facts. I think this is one of the most radical, I don't even know what to call it, concept of view, certainly, because certainly there are many people whose view is there are facts. You talk to me in a particular tone of voice. That meant X, Y, and Z. And in order for me to feel okay, you need to change your tone of voice. It is never true that somebody needs to change their tone of voice for you to feel okay. If your well-being depends on externals, you are in deep trouble. Everybody's is in deep trouble, because everybody's well-being depends on externals. But that's what we're doing here. That's exactly what we're doing here. We're here so that our fundamental sense of well-being does not depend on externals. Because externals change all the time. In the blink of an eye. Change. A friend of a friend was having breakfast with her husband on, what's today? Saturday. On Monday, he walked into the bathroom, had a heart attack, died. That was it. Now, I wouldn't be, well, I hope I would, but if that happened with me and Matt, I would be bereft. And I would have to, hopefully want to, hopefully know how to be with it, including the bereftness. Including that, because things change in an instant. People get sick, die, or some fabulous thing happens. both ends of the stick, so to speak. Both ends happen. And the more we are identified with our selves, our conditioned historical selves, which basically means being identified with our conclusions or what we learned or believe to be true about ourselves. That's kind of what a conclusion is, what an identity is. The more we're identified with our histories, with our conditioning, with what people told us, with what our mothers told us, with what our fathers told us. Remember what I said about note-taking. No note-taking. Maybe you weren't here the first night. Yeah. So the reason I said it is because if you write it down, your attention is somewhat split between taking in what's happening now and now and now and getting down what happened then or what I said. And if you start writing it down, then you're less present and available to what's happening now. So that's the reason I encourage all of you not to take notes. So what we're here to do and learn and be is who we are when we're not seeing through our wounds. And that is a high bar. It is a tall order. 99.99999% of people see through their wounds, have opinions about what should be and what shouldn't be, what you should have done that you didn't do, what Matt should have done. That's for the first many years of our lives. Well, there was a wildly falling in love period where he was perfect the way he was. And then there was the period of, I married the wrong person. I can't believe I ended up with him. What happened? And what was I thinking? Well, I didn't know then what I know now, and if I had known then what I know now, and I never would have X, Y, and Z'd. And, you know, I wanted him to be someone else, to be my version of what I believed was going to make me happy. If he was only X, Y, and Z, he'd make me happy. This wouldn't have happened. If only. I've talked to you all about that lovely spiritual teacher in the last century, Krishnamurti, who he said to a large audience one night, a friend of mine was in the audience, said, do you want to know what my secret is? And of course everybody said yes, they loved him. He said, I don't mind what happens. I don't mind what happens. I don't have opinions about what should be happening, what isn't happening, what you are not doing. All I know, well, I'm not saying he said this, and I'm not saying I don't have opinions because I do, although less and less, because I get it that my opinions and 5 cents will get me on the New York subway. That's how much my opinions are worth to anybody. It's what I said to you the other night, what Coco, this lovely teacher I work with in Maui, says, I don't care about my opinion. Why should I care about anybody else's? Because it makes no difference. It's just from history. You're just seeing out of your cloudy contact lenses. Okay, so then we come here to clear them up, to really take them off, to see as it is, to just see as it is. And then when you see as it is, you actually see. You see these colors, which are just incredibly gorgeous. You see colors. And somebody says something that triggers you, okay, you know immediately it's about me. You're not walking around taking offense at the people who don't act in consonance or resonance with how you want to feel, your view of yourself, your ideal view of yourself. They're not doing what they need to be doing in order to make you happy. It's radical what we're doing together. It's just, I don't even have words for how radical it is, because it shifts everything. It's the great unwinding. It's the great unwinding of who you take yourself to be. And so if you're not taking yourself to be your wounds, and you're not thinking that somebody else shouldn't be the way they're being, what's left? What's left? This freshness, this aliveness. You eat when you're hungry, most of the time. Stop when your body's had enough. Food becomes a non-issue. There's no issue because you're not trying to turn it into something it's not. You're not using it for comfort, to fill in the holes. So let's take just a few minutes, just sitting quietly. Notice if you're oriented, if you're grounded. Have you looked around? Have you noticed who's here? Have you landed so that you, it's not like you could be anywhere in any airport doing anything. Elisa, it's okay. You want to come and sit down? We're just starting. Yeah. Unless, of course, you want me to say to you, okay, we'll wait till you're ready. No, I'm not gonna say anything. Everybody's giving you things to suck on. Thanks, Sue. Thanks. Take a moment so you've oriented, you're grounded, meaning your feet are on the floor and you feel yourself here. Your butt's in the chair. You're allowing your body to be heavy, loose, and warm. Heavy, loose, and warm. And you're just allowing what's here to be here without reacting to it. No opinions about it. If what's here is an ache, a pain, a contraction, okay. as if you just arrived here. Pretend you just arrived here. Nothing to compare this moment to. Nothing can to compare this moment to. You just arrived here, there's sensation. With your eyes closed, if your eyes are closed, the whole world out there disappears. Just disappears. And you're here, and there's a freshness. Or not. Or you're snagged. You're triggered. You feel wounded. Okay. And you allow that. And then you open your eyes. So, this morning, I'm going to read you a little bit from the book I'm writing, which will be out in March of 2026. Almost done. Two-thirds of the way done. This piece is about food, which is what we're going to be talking about this morning. Not about this piece, but about your relationship with food. I'm sitting outside at a dinner party with 10 people, including Coco, on a balmy full moon July evening, and I'm trying to remember lines from Dorianne Lux's poem, Facts About the Moon, so I don't strangle the hostess. We don't deserve the moon. These are lines from her poem. Maybe we once did, but not now, after all we've done. It's 7:30. The party started at 6, and except for a handful of measly plastic-tasting corn chips and 3 ho-hum hummus spreads, no other food has arrived. 5 people around me say, I'm hungry. When is the food going to be served? But then, maddeningly, they continue sitting with legs crossed, burbling to the person next to them. Only I, it seems, am harboring an inner Draymond Green, the Golden State Warriors star who stomped on, choked, punched, and knocked out opponents who angered him. Until tonight, I've been disgusted with his outbursts. Keep it together, Draymond, I've yelled at the television screen, but he is my hero now, as civility and impulse control are waning, and my desire to stomp on the hostess's head is gaining traction. A few more lines from Lux's poem scrawl across my mind. What bothers me most is that someday the moon will spiral right out of orbit, and all land-based life will die. But then I think, to hell with orbits and death. What bothers me most is not the damn moon, but that Rose the hostess is nonchalantly, as if we weren't here, talking to Max. She finally moves into the kitchen. I am on her heels. Can I help? What can I do? She can't decide whether to put the food indoors on a buffet table or outdoors. And I say, perhaps too forcefully, put it anywhere. Just put it. I take the dishes out of the oven, the microwave, the refrigerator. She asks the guest to form a circle, say a blessing to thank everyone for coming, and goes on to thank the earth, the rain, the people who grew it, picked it, delivered it. Will she also, I think, thank the steering wheels, the brake pedals, the washing machines that clean the clothes of the truck drivers? I am, it seems, closer and closer to going off the rails. And then it's time to eat. I scoop curried fish and roasted broccoli onto my plate, go outside, eat, and upon finishing the last bite, consider my descent into almost madness, which now that it's over, feels as if I've woken from a drunken stupor and I'm looking around to see where I dropped my clothes. I have a hangover, muted shock and amazement from my violent inclinations, and I decide it's best to remove myself to Rose's backyard, as I am certain that saying, "So, did you want to kill Rose too?" wouldn't qualify as party talk. The plumeria tree in the garden where I now walk fills the air with a creamy, citrusy fragrance that is so overwhelming, so enveloping, so heavenly, it makes me want to dive into it and disappear. I smile at the image of disappearing and think, well, that'd be a convenient way to avoid reckoning with wanting to pummel Rose. I don't know where to start. I don't have low blood pressure, so wanting to punch her did not come from extreme hunger. I don't usually like parties, but there was so much about being there that was loveliness itself, looking at the saucer moon, listening to the rustling of the wind through the palm trees, festooning Rose with leis, orchids and plumeria and tuberose, one on top of the other. It's clear I realize that I still have a food issue. Not a weight issue. Not a stop when you're full issue. Not a which food shall I eat issue. Not an overeating issue, but a food issue. Food was my best friend during the 17 years I gained and lost so much weight. It was always there. It was always comforting. It always tasted good. It didn't talk back. It didn't go away. It didn't hit or yell or lie. One of my teachers said, "You never divorce anyone. The imprints of a relationship live inside you forevermore." Same, it seems to be true with the relationship with food. There are times, not many of them, that I still eat before I eat. Crumbs of crackers, wedges of sweet potato, spoonfuls of sauce. There are times I still store for the hunger to come by eating slightly more than enough. 6 or 7 on a scale of 1 to 10. Sometimes I eat quickly, almost furtively, as if my mother will catch me and I'll get in trouble. Sometimes I still act as if I am stealing food, as if I'm not supposed to receive pleasure from what was previously forbidden. I still prefer sweet foods over any other foods, a habitual response to being told I was not allowed to eat them, and I still eat chocolate twice a day to say fuck you to everyone who told me I was allergic to it. And although I know that these behaviors are a reaction to what I was told I shouldn't or should do as a child, I notice now that I don't care. Without judgments of any of these behaviors, without judgments, there is no suffering, no fight, no story, no good or bad. Eventually, I assume the patterns will do what all patterns do when they are not resisted. they will die of neglect, like a once-used path in the forest, now covered with moss and scattered leaves. And if they don't disappear, if they sing their food songs for the rest of my life, it's fine with me. I have no preference here. In the dappled light of the buck moon, which is not doing its job, I might add, because when I looked it up a few days ago, a buck moon purported to offer grounding, centering, and all-around sanity, I realize once again that all food issues are life issues, that any issue about or with food threads through everything, every non-edible relationship, every life situation, that how you eat is truly how you live. In the garden, I decide with all the authority of a lone individual walking in a garden on a full moon that disorganized eating is a better descriptor than disordered eating. Because disorder does not have the significance or import of the fundamental incoherence of feeling, thinking, and living that gets projected onto food and looks like it is about food. I'm not going to read you the rest. I'm going to skip to the very end. How are you doing so far? Well, the next day, I see Coco. When I see Coco the next day, she says, "So how did you like the party?" I went slightly crazy, I respond, fingering the tassels on a throw pillow of her couch. "Oh, what happened?" I recount the dream in green facsimile. "I wanted to mow Rose down," I tell her. She smiles the tiniest bit. I see she says and adds, "Maybe I should stop saying that since I am blind and I don't see a thing." I smile, which she also can't see, and wait for her next sentence. "Sounds like you were triggered." "Yep," I say. "And what was the feeling?" "Frustration, anger." And she asks, "What was the conclusion?" "That I was irrelevant, might as well not exist. We have just gone through a laser version of the first four of the six steps, the trigger, the understanding that it's about me, and the feeling." Coco asks if I can recount an early memory of feeling irrelevant. Then I say, this is the part I'm going to skip through. You'll have to read the book to see how I went through the six steps with her and the big unpacking of it. I tell her, "I don't like dredging up memories. I've had enough of going through these fucking six steps." Coco says, "If that were true, if it really was enough, you wouldn't have wanted to kill Rose." I recognize that this is true, but I don't like it, and I tell her that. A minute passes, 2 minutes. "You know, Janine, the level of neglect you experienced was shocking. Your mother was an extreme narcissist. She treated you as if you were invisible, as if your existence didn't register." "Oh, God," I say, "here we go again and again and again." "Not really," Coco says. "I'm not sure we've ever gone there." And then I go there. And so I'm going to skip to the end. I gotta say, we're almost at the end here, one little paragraph before then, I tell Coco, "I get angry at my mother all over again when I tell these stories. And I'm starting to feel awfully sorry for myself. I understand, she says. And when you take yourself to be the adult version of that child, you will. But we're recalling the memory so you can name and dispel the conclusions you've been seeing your life through. That's the only reason we're doing this. And those conclusions are, I'm irrelevant. My existence does not matter. It's not what happened, sweetheart, she says. It's what you decided about yourself, about what happened. Growing up with your mother was a shit show, a bad movie, and you're still taking yourself at times, not often, but at times, and last night was one of them, to be the character in that movie. But here's the thing. You aren't that character because you couldn't be telling me about her if you were. You can get up and walk out of the theater now. Our hour is up. Thank God. Oh, wait. I say I'm irrelevant. How could you be irrelevant? How could your existence not matter? You made up those conclusions and you keep sticking to them like they are truth. It's like having a shitty-ass ugly baby and saying, it's mine, it's mine, and I'm not going to let it go. I'm not going to let this wounded child go. Our hour is up, thank God. My brain is sticking together like wet spaghetti. But as soon as I think of spaghetti, I think of meatballs. And as soon as I think of meatballs, I think about garlic bread. Then suddenly, I am at Mosca's, a restaurant in New Orleans, eating garlic bread and lemon icebox pie for dessert. Food to the rescue. Food is distraction. Food is comfort. I'm giddy, I tell Coco. I know there is freedom in what you are saying, but right now, I just want garlic bread. She says, again, your childhood was a bad movie, a shit show, and it continues to affect you, but only when you take yourself to be the character of that movie. Turning to food was a brilliant adaptive behavior. It kept you from feeling the chaos you had no way of truly being with. Yet, I say, I turned the despair about my parents into the despair about being fat. Smart girl, Coco says. Now you can name and feel the chaos that has been there since you were 2 or 3. That surfaced at Rose Party and realize you're not it. It's a shitty-ass, ugly baby, darling. It's time to put her down. Shouldn't it be shitty-ass, ugly face, baby, I asked? You're forgetting the word face in there. And before she can answer, I step outside. The pastel's blue sky is heart-stoppingly gorgeous, and the puffy clouds look like mashed potatoes. They are good enough to eat. So what did you hear when you listened to that? What do you hear? And then we're going to do a process about food and you. What did you hear? Yeah. It's a lifelong process. What else? Yeah. Wanting to punch somebody and mow them down is a trigger. Means I've been triggered. What else did you hear? Yeah.
I heard you have a truly lousy childhood.
Right, as did all of you. Although some of us felt loved by their mother. So there's a difference sometimes in degrees. But because we were all born to imperfect parents, it's what happens. Wounding is part of being in Earth School. What else? Yes.
I heard that.
Yes. Right. So it's a process. What else? Yes, humor is very helpful. Really helpful. And if you can see it, you're not it. Now, I couldn't, when I was sitting at that party and wanting to kill Rose, I was aware that I was sitting at a party and wanting to kill her. I was aware of that. That was clear. And I was also aware that I was feeling insane. So both those things are true. I was aware that I wasn't going to act out. I was not going to start punching her. I wasn't going to do that. I mean, I had enough impulse control and awareness to not do that, but I was aware I wanted to. Although I haven't really hit anybody, I don't think ever, in my life. So, you know, hitting Rose because of lousy hummus and potato chips, without, you know, nah. Somebody else? Anybody else? No, and that part that I read you about the things that I still do with food at times that aren't a problem. I don't suffer about them anymore. I don't make myself sick, I don't binge, I don't this, I do that, but, you know, do I follow those 7 eating guidelines perfectly every day? No. No suffering about it. It doesn't affect how I feel in my body, it doesn't affect my weight, which is another way of saying it doesn't affect the ease with which I'm able to move. If affected that, I there'd be some work to do there.
Support.
I think when you are superlatively triggered, the way I was that night, I was ready to see a level of neglect from my childhood that I hadn't been willing to see before. That was 4 years, so that was a while back, as at least a year ago. I don't remember exactly when, but I've been doing this conclusion work. I met Coco in probably very early 2020. So it's been 5 years that I've been doing this consistently. Whenever, every single time I get triggered, which means every time I feel charged about something. I don't always willingly or happily do the work, like that other night when I told you about when I was on the phone and this friend cut me off. I didn't automatically go into the 6 steps, but I will sooner or later go into them because it's all there is to do. Because so what? Whether she did or didn't, now it wasn't a trigger like this was a trigger. This was a trigger I hadn't felt in years since I started doing the conclusion work, since my friend stopped talking to me, and that was 5 years ago. So it hasn't been that level of trigger for a while. In the beginning, when you first start doing this, there are a lot of triggers, and food is the perfect doorway in to the triggers. Every time you eat compulsively, that you feel charged about it, judgmental about it, criticize yourself about it, where you realize it's a distraction, then it's time to look. Because compulsive eating is a trigger. Now, whether you do it once in a while, are you cold, Amit? Judy, what's the temperature in here? Really? I think it feels cold too. Uh-huh. Well, could you open that door over there and let... Oh. You see, you try to fix the circumstances on the outside, and it just doesn't work. You try to make yourself comfortable, and what happens? So, emotional eating, compulsive eating, not following the eating guidelines, that those are all triggers. When something, usually, if you're still dealing with or challenged by issues with food, if you're not at your natural weight, if you're not feeling utterly comfortable in your body, if you find yourself following a habitual pattern of eating every day at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, no matter what, or whenever you feel rejected, if there are triggers, it's time to look. Now, we're going to divide up into groups of five in a moment, and we're going to be doing this work. It just really is helpful to see that we're doing this to clear up the lenses, to take off the contact lenses. That most people don't. You know, I'll tell you what my editor said to me the other day. A friend sent me a ChatGPT version of one of... I'm writing a chapter now called If I Had a Daughter. And a friend sent me a ChatGPT version of what that version would be by Jeanine Roth. And, you know, out comes three or four pages of writing that kind of sort of sounds like me. Not exactly, but kind of. And I'm not even sure why I'm telling you this story, but hopefully if I keep telling it, I'll remember. I sent it to my editor. I'm working with two editors. One, I sent it to one of them. And she sent her the ChatGPT version of the chapter she knows I'm working on because I've been going back and forth with her on it. And her response to me was, A-C-K, make it stop. And I realized nothing takes the place of really doing the work. And she wrote back and she said, to be fair, this writing is better than 99.99999% of what most people can write, but not you. So don't listen. But you have to. I realized when I saw what ChatGPT wrote instead of me, it was like, I could have written my whole book like this. I just tell them, write in the style of Jeanine Roth. And then I did ask them, what's Jeanine Roth's style? It came back, sensitive, introspective, personally revealing, vulnerable, makes the connection. It was like, yeah. Okay, write the goddamn book for me. I've been writing this book. It's been 4 years I've been working on this book. ChatGPT came out with this thing in like 30 seconds. So now I remember what I want to say. So I could do that. Becky knew the difference between me and ChatGPT. But what I realized is I love writing. I love the process of writing. I want to learn what I learn when I write. When I write, I find out what I know that I didn't know I knew. I write into something that I didn't even know was there before I started writing. How this has to do with what we're doing, not that all of you are writers or wanna be, that you've gotta wanna do this. You've gotta love turning towards yourself. You've gotta love finding what's true. You've got to love discovering who are you really when you're not identified with your wounds, when you're not a character in the movie. Who are you? Now, is that possible to not be conditioned by our families and by our caretakers? It's just not possible. Every single kid is. Some worse than others. Some have had a major shit show of a childhood. Some have had a little shit show. But it's kind of been a shit show for everybody, only because of, you know, our parents didn't know who they were. So if they didn't know who they were, how do they show you who you are? Unless, of course, your mother's 96 and suddenly enlightened. And I do say to her, Mom, you could have said these things to me 60 years ago. It would have helped then. And she says, it's better now than never. Nothing goes in. No sense of guilt or blame. Aren't you glad I'm doing it now? She's going to be in Miss Senior America pageant, by the way. Wow. I'll let you know when she is. She's wearing a blue sequin dress. Okay, we're going to divide up into groups of five. Do you have your sheets of the six steps? You're going to need them. Groups of five, circles of five, groups of five. Okay. So take out those sheets. So each, this is how this is going to work. Each of you is going to have 5 minutes. 5 minutes. The topic is food. The topic is how you eat, your relationship with food. The topic is how you've been triggered by anything external, regardless of what it is, something that's happened, ideally since you've been here. Ideally since you've been here. It doesn't need to be since you've been here, but we really want to focus on how these steps relate to our expressed in, externalized through, whatever word you want to use, your relationship with food, which basically means how your conclusions play out in your relationship with food. Now, I want to say something about conclusions. There really aren't that many of them in the world, in our culture, at least. I mean, according to the Dalai Lama, who doesn't understand what lack of self-worth means at all, because it's not anything that's alive with Tibetans. And his response is often, why is everybody focused, this is a direct quote, on the externals? Why not just on the internals? And it's not about lack of self-worth, which he doesn't even know about. It's like, you know, I'm sure you've heard about this. When Christopher Columbus arrived with the Nina, Pinta, and Santa Maria on the shores of wherever it was he arrived, the native people didn't recognize what the ships were because they'd never seen them before. They had no context for the ships, therefore, they didn't know most of them were going to get killed with the guns on there. So we have a lot of context in terms of the relationship with food and externalizing this relationship and how it gets projected, how our conclusions get projected. What I was saying is, there are only basically, I don't know, there's like a basket of conclusions. I'm not enough. I'm irrelevant. I'm all alone. Things never work out for me. I'm a failure. I'm unworthy. I'm damaged at the core. You know, they basically fit into a basket, and everybody's got a version of them. Everybody's got a version of one of those. So you're going to look, you're going to take 5 minutes. And somebody said about how support is important. Yes, in all its different guises. This is support. Going through the 6 steps with 4 other people listening to you. So you start with something you did around food in the last couple of days, or earlier in the week, or 2 weeks ago, or a recent binge, or whatever. The most recent thing would be the best because it's the freshest. You know, I came back from that party and I wrote this piece the next day. It'd be impossible for me to write this now because it's so far away. So it's good to get it fresh. What happened recently? State what it was, and then, so I'm triggered. I'm triggered. So you need to be triggered to do these 6 steps. Something, you have to be charged about something. It's about me. And it's not in there, but what I did about it was eat. What I did about it was eat. That's what I did. I turned to food. That's somehow between the 3rd and 4th step. What's the feeling? It could be step 2A. It could be step 3A. What I did about it, that doesn't say what I did. Because this is just about, I'm triggered, it's about me. What's the feeling? What's an earlier version of the feeling? What's the conclusion like that? We want to use food as a step down here. So that when you're at home, you can do this exact same thing with yourself. So you're doing it in a group so that you can do it with yourself when you get home. I could lead you in a visualization, and we'll probably do one this afternoon, but having me do it is different than you do it. So you do it. You go through these steps with the addition of what you did, how food entered into it, your relationship with food. And what are the conclusions that are externalized in your relationship with food? That's what we want to discover. We want to unwind those. We want to dismantle those. We want to see through those. We want to name those. And when you name those, again, it's like sitting in the movie theater, watching the movie. Naming is disengaging. Naming is watching. All right? Okay. So, each of you has 5 minutes. And what I'd like you to do is really listen. And as you're listening to somebody else, see how it affects you. This is active listening. You are really supporting somebody to do the most essential work. Okay, please go. Time, no crosstalk. This isn't conversation. One person at a time. Which doesn't mean, I want to say one thing, that somebody else's trigger or process wouldn't also evoke yours. And so when somebody goes, if you want to go next, almost like those groups where you write a poem and somebody starts with one line of a poem and then the next person goes with the next line of the poem and the next line. This could be that if this was true for you. If it brought up what was true for you, you could just follow up. Okay, please go. Okay, everybody, time to get back. So what did you discover? Yeah. I want to control everything. Well, then you must feel unsafe a lot.
I do.
That's right. Heidi said she wants to control everything. It makes her feel safe. And yeah. So my question to all of you, for whom this, because this conclusion comes up a lot for you. Two things about a conclusion that comes up a lot is to, first of all, to notice. So do you say to yourself, this is a lie? This is not true. It sounds to me like you still believe it, that you still merge with the one who feels she's not doing it wrong, that you still believe that. Yes. And one way you can think of it is as an attachment to your wound, to the wound, that if you let it go. So imagine for a second, everybody, not just Rachel, although I will be asking Rachel this question. Imagine yourself without that wound. Who would you be? Who are you without your number one go-to wound? Who are you? If you just got up, Rachel, and walked out of the theater while this was going on, I always do it wrong, I don't eat the right things, there's a new health thing and I'm not doing that right, I just always get it wrong. If you got up and left, if that was a costume you are wearing, that you've gotten so used to this costume that you put on. It's like a role you're playing in a play. And you've gotten so used to being that role that you don't ever take off. You walk in the door and you don't ever take off the costume. You don't ever stop playing that role. You're in character all the time. Imagine all of you, what would it be like to take off the costume? To stop playing that role. To not be in character. I know it's hard. I get it. I really do get how hard this is. What a high bar we're talking about. Most people spend their lives in character. Most people spend their entire lives playing that character. That's what we call a life. That's what we call a life. And what a lot of therapy, at least the therapy I did, was first of all acknowledging what happened and acknowledging how it affected me and titrating how it affected me on a day-to-day basis. Having things I said to myself to feel better, realizing I wasn't that. Old beliefs, new beliefs. It wasn't what we're doing here, and I know you're a therapist. What we're doing here is dismantling the character. We're dismantling the me person. It's different than therapy, which absolutely has its place. It does. It's so important. And what we're doing is, if there's no me person here, and by that I mean no character, no role I'm playing, no costume I'm wearing, if I take off those contact lenses, if I don't see the world as my wound is. What's left? Because, and I've said this to those of you who have been working with me for the last many years before, all you ever experience is who you're being to yourself. That's it. That's it. You can't even hear how somebody else is being with you, really, truly being with you, because you're just looking out of your eyes, your contact lenses. All we ever experience is who we're being to ourselves. That's it. So when you change how you feel about yourself, or that Anna Eastman quote, we don't see the world as it is, we see it as we are. So your view of what you're eating has nothing to do with anything but the lie that you're telling yourself about who you are. And it's sobering, it's enlightening, it's liberating to say to yourself, I've been believing a lie my whole life. And so, and we're going to talk more about this afternoon, but one practice to do is to live as if. Live as if you are not that. You're not that. But if it seems impossible to disengage from the shitty-ass, ugly-faced baby, and that's basically what you're holding on to. You're holding on to a shitty-ass, ugly-faced baby and saying, it's mine. It might be shitty-ass and ugly-faced, but it's mine. And I'm not letting go of it. It might be throwing up, have diarrhea all over the place. It might just be the worst thing. But it's mine. And I'm not letting go. Living as if. So let's check in with hunger levels, because I just walked by the buffet table out there. It looks quite lovely. Of course, I didn't pick up all the dishes, but I saw the menu. Check in with your hunger right now. One is really hungry, five is comfortable, 10 is stuffed. Four or below, you're hungry, five or above, you're not. And how do you feel about eating? It's coming right up. So let me see hands, fingers for how hungry you are. All right. Most of you are hungry. So we will be doing an eating meditation now. So just getting a sense of yourself. Notice if you're triggered now. Notice how your belly's feeling, how your heart. Just notice. And let's take one moment. Kathy, why don't you come up here?